there's a whole new ocean opening up that we have responsibilities for.
The new Coast Guard commander in Alaska highlights the Arctic. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 19th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, residents of Crooked Creek are struggling to get by after more than half the village was destroyed by flood.
Reality is setting in, and people are getting a little, oh my goodness, what are we going to do?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
U.S. Senate Republicans blocked moving forward on voting whether to confirm a Ninth Circuit Court judge today, but Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski bucked her party and voted to advance toward a final yay or nay vote. President Obama's nominee to fill a vacant spot on the Ninth Circuit, the jurisdiction of which includes Alaska, is Goodwin Liu, Associate Dean at the University of California Berkeley Law School. Murkowski was the only Republican who voted to move forward, but her office says she would have voted against actually making Liu a circuit court judge. The senator voted on the principle that she believes nominees should have an up or down vote and not get blocked in the lead-up process. Since the presidency of George W. Bush, a group of Democrats and Republicans agreed they would only filibuster or block votes in extraordinary circumstances. It takes 60 votes to get past a filibuster, but President Obama's nominee got just 52 today. The new commander of the U.S. Coast Guard's 17th District says ratification of the Law of the Sea Treaty remains a top Coast Guard priority. Rear Admiral Thomas Astubo took over for Rear Admiral Christopher Colvin today at a change of command ceremony on the pier at Coast Guard Station Juneau. As KTOO's Casey Kelly reports, Astubo says he'll continue many initiatives from Colville's tenure, including a focus on Arctic issues.
As the Air Force Band of the Pacific played a series of marches, a crowd assembled to celebrate Rear Admiral Christopher Colvin's 2 years heading up Coast Guard operations in Alaska. Pacific Area Commander Vice Admiral Manson Brown says the Coast Guard's expanding mission begins in the Arctic.
I recognize that this Alaskan audience, more than most, understands the dynamics that are playing out in the Arctic today. And as our Commandant Admiral Bob Papp has recently stated, there's a whole new ocean opening up that we have responsibilities for.
Brown noted that as much as 20% of the world's untapped oil and gas resources are in the Arctic, and other nations are already exploring and staking claims in the area.
These operations will continue to expand, and the Coast Guard needs to ensure that it is prepared to meet both our sovereign and statutory responsibilities, including environmental response.
Alaska politicians universally support U.S. ratification of the Law of the Sea Treaty. The Coast Guard's new commander of Alaska operations, Rear Admiral Thomas Astubo, says the treaty continues to be a top priority.
The position of the Coast Guard, the position of the Joint Staff, is to advance the Law of the Sea Treaty, get that ratified so that we have a seat at the table, and obviously our processes have to go through, but my marching orders and initiative would continue to move forward.
Law of the Sea would extend the United States' exclusive control of the ocean bottom off Alaska's northern coast to 440 miles offshore, where currently the nation only has control up to 200 miles. Astubo says ratification would allow the Coast Guard to better define its expanding role in the region.
Once we have that done, then we'll be in a position to describe our mission change and how that would look. And then, you know, resources always seem to follow at the end. Once we understand what our missions are, what our requirements are, where we'll need to be as the environment changes and the legislative profile around the world through the Law of the Sea changes.
In addition to oil and gas, the Coast Guard's mission in Alaska includes service and protection of the fishing and visitor industries, as well as homeland security and search and rescue. Colvin thanked Alaskans for their unique understanding of that mission.
The Coast Guard is blessed by the support that all Alaskans provide the Coast Guard, especially their leaders.
Colvin's next assignment is Deputy of Pacific Area Command in Alameda, California. This is something of a homecoming for Ostabo. From 1987 to 1992, he flew helicopters and served as Chief Aviation Engineer at Air Station Sitka. He and wife Renee named one of their two daughters Denali. Ostabo spent the past 7 years in Washington, D.C. as the Coast Guard's Assistant Commandant for Engineering and Logistics. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Governor Sean Parnell declared a state disaster for the Kuskokwim villages of Crooked Creek and Red Devil, which flooded during breakup. About 66% of housing in Crooked Creek was damaged or destroyed, and Red Devil also experienced damage, but to a lesser degree. The Red Cross has stepped up efforts in Crooked Creek. Meanwhile, residents there are struggling each day to figure out how to live with what's left after the flood. KYUK's Angela Denning Barnes was in the village and has the story.
I gotta drop this stuff off. It's food for these guys.
Okay.
John Anderson is Crooked Creek's cab driver, but his job description over the last week has grown to include supplies delivery.
12, 14 hours a day, I'm bringing people back to school for, they feed, the Red Cross feeds them back there, and so I bring them back and forth. Your food's in the back in the box.
Huh?
There's some food back for you guys, Danny.
Grab that grub.
You want to grab that box, John, please?
Receiving part of the food was John Thomas Sr., the village mechanic. Like Anderson, he has been very busy doing his part to get the town back together. And at the same time, he's in awe of what actually happened.
Every year we break up, I put all the equipment back there by the bridge. All of it. All our equipment goes back there. And, it went underwater. Everything went underwater.
Thomas's house is about a half mile up the bank from the main village, and it was the only one in the area not to be destroyed.
Man, my house was high enough, it just missed our soffit, but man, it ruined my sewer line, everything.
There are still huge boulders of ice covering the road to his house, some of it over 30 feet high. To get to town, Thomas walks along the riverbank near the water, which takes him 45 minutes to 1 hour. He says the thing he would like to fix the most is his water supply.
Water. We're cut off up there. I mean, it's like a separate town up there. You can't get there because of that cliff. And there's a little creek. It's a pain in the ass walking back and forth. Should I carry 5 gallons of water that far? I smoke too much. It's like you're going to die, man.
It's depressing. And we don't know where to turn. And we don't know who to talk to.
Miska Andronoff and his wife Agnes are hanging out at the school. Unlike Anderson and Thomas, they can't do the work that they want to do.
It would be good if we would go to our fish camp, which is about 8 or 9 miles upriver.
If I had a boat and motor now, I'd be gone up to my fish camp. I wouldn't have to worry about down here for a while, a place to live. But right now, our hands are tied. We can't do nothing.
Now is the time for villagers to get fish camp ready for subsistence fishing, which will help feed them through the winter. But like the Andronoffs, most people can't leave town.
Reality is setting in, and people are getting a little, oh my goodness, what are we going to do?
Evelyn Thomas is the tribal administrator for the village. She says it's overwhelming for some people to see all the destruction after they had been evacuated for 4 days. But she says there is hope. Red Cross set up 2 large tents as temporary shelters near the school, and there's a supplies tent set up at either end of town for people to come get the basics like toilet paper and soap.
I never in my life thought I would be happy to see a broom. And I was thrilled to see these brooms come off a plane. Because we can't find our broom. It floated somewhere.
Thomas is thankful for all the donations and help they've received from regional entities in Bethel, such as the Yukon Kuskokwim Health Corporation, which has kept a nurse and environmental health staff in the village since the flood happened. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, students in St. Michael cope with the loss of their metal shop.
They had it almost, the outside almost done, and then a couple of youths burned it down.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
The State Department of Health and Social Services is cooperating fully into the investigation of an Anchorage woman charged with abusing six adopted children and an undetermined number of foster children. Anya James has been charged with 10 counts of kidnapping and 6 counts of first-degree assault for the abuse she perpetrated against children in her care over the past decade. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The Department of Health and Social Services and the Office of Children's Services are cooperating with law enforcement in the full investigation and prosecution of the charges filed against Anya James. Christy Lawton, director of the Office of Children's Services, says the children are safe now and their physical and emotional needs are being closely monitored. Lawton spoke through a prepared statement, saying also that the department is unable to answer specific questions about the case because of the ongoing investigation. The questions go back at least a decade, according to Anchorage police, who are working on the case. James was a licensed foster parent from 1994 to 2005, according to records. James also adopted 6 children, the last one in 2004. When removed from James's home in October of 2010, the 4 children still living with her then showed signs of starvation to the point that normal physical development did not occur. One child was hospitalized at the time, according to APD spokeswoman Anita Schell.
Anya James restricted the diets to the children, which led them to become severely malnourished.
By the time the investigation began, 2 of James's adopted children had already left the home. They are aged 21 now, and the 4 removed from the home last year range in age from 13 to 20. According to a memo to the court by State Prosecutor Tally Henry, the oldest of the adopted children filed a complaint with OCS last October, setting the investigation in motion.
When the police arrived and they saw the children, they looked like children. You know, several of them actually were adults, but they looked much younger than their actual age. And that's the state's theory is that's due to the malnourishment and the fact that Ms. James wasn't providing them with enough food to eat, basically. The lanugo is the downy hair, and that's characteristic of victims of starvation or anorexia. It's basically a sign that your body's not getting enough food. And that was present on several of the victims.
Alice James told investigators that the children were fed a mix of oatmeal, mashed potatoes, and uncooked eggs, and forced to write 20 pages in a journal each day before getting food. The children were kept in a converted garage with cement floors, used a kitty litter box instead of a toilet, and were confined to small spaces that were electronically monitored to detect egress. Why the abuse at the James household was not detected until so recently is puzzling. A neighbor on James's street had filed complaints with authorities but was ignored. OCS's Christy Lawton says the state does not monitor the environment of adopted children once the court has approved the adoption.
You know, every time we place a child for adoption with a family, we are doing a home study that would be looked at for each and every time and evaluated of whether or not they can meet the needs of that child and what the needs of any other children in their home are, adopted or otherwise. So that's a really intense critical review that's done before a child is finalized for adoption.
Anya James's attorney, Rex Butler, has filed not guilty pleas on behalf of James. James was arraigned Wednesday in Alaska Superior Court in Anchorage. James collected some $750,000 in state adoption subsidies in the decade from 2000 to 2010, as well as the 6 children's permanent fund checks. Some of the children also had income from Alaska Native Corporation dividend checks, which James kept. James homeschooled the children as well. Assistant DA Henry says there is a possibility that further charges against Anya James could be filed. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
There was a fire in the Norton Sound community of St. Michael last night. No one was injured, but some students in the town of about 370 people are learning the lesson of hard work and dedication. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin has the story.
Students and staff at the St. Michael School are trying to keep a positive attitude this week. Since September, students had been building what was going to be a metals shop and had the exterior of the building complete.
They'd been working on it hard during the warm months in the fall, and then they had it almost, the outside almost done, and then a couple youths burned it down.
St. Michael Principal Dan Idy said that on Wednesday evening at about 7:30, they noticed smoke coming out from behind the school. He said they went and saw that the shop was in flames and all they could do was watch. St. Michael does have local volunteer firefighters who were at the scene. However, they were not able to get an adequate water hose in the area in time to fight the fire. And according to a trooper's investigation, children had been playing with a lighter and an aerosol can. Principal Idy says the actions of the youth setting the fire had been intentional. There was an all-school meeting today with students and school staff that was held to talk about the incident.
Our theme for this conversation was, thieves may steal your efforts, your things, but you don't have to give them your heart, your soul, or your pride.
Idy says they don't want this incident to ruin the pride and the efforts that the students have experienced in the past year.
The kids have worked hard. They, you know, they took lots of pride in their project and in building the shop. And so we wanted to focus on the good things. And hopefully, you know, hopefully again, we can, after we get it cleaned up, we can start again.
ID says they will be working to get the funding necessary to purchase material to begin rebuilding the shop. The fire is still under investigation by the Alaska State Troopers. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinnean.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at FullCircle.com. How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The Arctic Council is bringing attention to the issue of mercury contamination in subsistence foods. A new assessment from the Council's monitoring program finds high levels of the metal in marine mammals. But the report shows mercury levels in Alaska tend to be much lower than other parts of the Arctic. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Much of the mercury in the Arctic arrives in the atmosphere from coal-burning power plants in Asia, and under certain conditions, it undergoes a transformation that makes it much more harmful. It's a complicated process, but Thomas Douglas, who worked on the Arctic Council report, sums it up.
The simple thing is you take sea ice, you take gaseous mercury, you take some sunlight, and you can basically deposit this mercury to, you know, the terrestrial surface and the sea ice surface.
Douglas is a research chemist with the Army Corps of Engineers in Fairbanks. He says the process is unique to the polar regions.
This doesn't happen in Florida. It doesn't happen in Texas. It doesn't happen in Vermont kind of thing. You really need sea ice and cold temperatures.
That's one reason animals in the Arctic tend to have high levels of mercury. Polar bears have some of the highest levels because they eat high on the food chain. Bowhead whales are at the other end of the spectrum. Cheryl Rosa is deputy director of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission and a bowhead biologist.
They would be essentially the cows of the ocean. If they were on land, they'd be eating grass. They're feeding on the very small animals in the ocean, the krill, euphausids, copepods, amphipods, really small animals that aren't high in the food chain because mercury tends to bioaccumulate, biomagnify as you go up the food chain.
The mercury levels in walrus and seals fall somewhere in the middle. Lori Quakenbush is a biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. The department has collected about 10 years of contaminant data on four species of seals harvested in Alaska.
The one thing that we can say is that seals in Alaska have lower levels of all of these compounds than seals in other places in the Arctic, like Canada and Europe. So we know our levels are lower than levels in other places.
No one knows exactly why the levels are lower in Alaska, but several studies have documented it. Quakenbush says the seals also appear to be detoxifying some of the mercury, a process she and other scientists are studying.
Marine mammals are very good at combining the toxic form of mercury, the methylmercury, with another element called selenium. And even though it may be that the total amount of mercury in the seal tissue that we test looks a little bit high, the fact that they're detoxifying it with this other element is what we're studying, how much of it is actually not available for either people or bears that eat the seals.
The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium studies mercury levels in pregnant women in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Dr. James Berner is a science director at the consortium. He says the women have much higher mercury levels than the U.S. population as a whole, but the levels are still at or below FDA guidelines. Dr. Berner says the Arctic Council report should help marine mammal hunters in Alaska feel better about what they eat.
There was a lot of misinformation and fear on the part of the consuming public in the Arctic. And that's now been replaced by a lot more knowledge.
Vera Metcalf is executive director of the Alaska Eskimo Walrus Commission. She says mercury contamination is on the minds of Alaskans who eat marine mammals, but it doesn't stop them from enjoying the food.
I think they're concerned. We try not to alarm everyone because that's our main diet right now. It's very expensive to buy any kind of processed food from a local store. So many of us rely on these resources, which we hope will remain healthy and for our future generation.
Metcalf says monitoring contaminant levels in subsistence foods is important, and she makes the case for reinstating federal funds for the Alaska Marine Mammal Tissue Archival Project. That allows long-term banking of samples from subsistence mammals. Cheryl Rosa with the Arctic Research Commission is also hoping funding for the program will be restored.
Since 2006, there have been next to no tissues that have been collected in this manner as a long-term archive in the state of Alaska, which is just an absolute travesty. It's a shame that this isn't happening.
Rosa says the tissue bank is important because it will aid future studies on contaminants.
What's the next new toxin that's going to pop up? You know, it's just being able to go back and to look for these things is so important. You know, there's things around now that we didn't look for 10 or 15 years ago.
Rosa points out it would only cost $100,000 a year to fund the program, and she says that's a small amount for something so important. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Experts say early studies show catches of some species of fish that live in Alaska may drop after being exposed to intense sound. But the science is inconclusive, so the U.S. Navy announced last week that they're going ahead with training that includes use of sonar in the Gulf of Alaska. From member station KDLG, Daisha Eaton has the story.
Kelly Harrell is the executive director of the Alaska Marine Conservation Council. She's concerned marine life could soon be hearing this.
Just a couple of days ago, the Navy approved their record of decision to move forward with new training activities in the Gulf of Alaska. So we're very concerned about the impacts of underwater noise from sonar and some of these other activities, the use of explosives that are now going to take place in the Gulf of Alaska, and very dismayed at the handling of the lack of information on the potential impacts to those very valuable commercially important fish species.
Species like halibut, salmon, and the endangered North Pacific right whale. The Navy Environmental Impact Statement released May 11th says that since there's no conclusive science on the impact of sonar and other sounds on fish, the Navy will go ahead with exercises in the Gulf. Jason Godomke works for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. He's an expert on how sounds like sonar affect marine mammals. Godomke says researchers are now branching out to take a look at how all kinds of sounds are affecting a host of species.
It's not just marine mammals that may be affected by man-made sound in the ocean, but it's also fish.
Godomke says the research on how fish are faring in an increasingly noisy ocean is in its infancy. Experts say early studies show that catches of some species of fish like haddock, cod, and herring may drop down after being exposed to intense sounds. Godomke says they don't have any concrete answers about how such sounds affect fish yet, but the ideas about how sound affects fish come out of research on marine mammals.
When we talk about marine mammals and things, there we're talking about, you know, a whole range of reactions from just simple behavioral changes to, you know, where the animals might move away to no reaction whatsoever. You know, they may not react to it at all. But there's also possible implications for, say, masking of communication. So if we look at sort of a low-level sound that's just put into the environment that raises the background level throughout a large area of the ocean, certain animals may not be able to communicate over as large distances as they were previously.
In the last 10 years or so, the interest has got switched over to some degree to be on fish, although they're not nearly as cute as most marine mammals.
That's Art Popper, a professor at the University of Maryland. He's one of the few scientists researching how noise affects fish. He says the idea of sound masking, man-made sound drowning out normal ocean sounds, is kind of like...
If you go to a party and you're talking to somebody and the background noise gets raised behind you, what happens is it's harder to talk to the person you're speaking with. You've had that experience, I'm sure. We have a lot of lab studies to show this thing called masking takes place. No one's gone out in the field and done experiments to see how this really impacts animals in the wild.
Scientists are afraid that masking could potentially limit the ability of fish to communicate with each other or to detect prey. In addition, Popper says loud noises could simply cause fish to try to get away, much like a human crossing the street to avoid a jackhammer on a city sidewalk. This could potentially alter feeding patterns or spawning activity. The next step, he says, is to take those experiments out into the oceans. But those experiments would be expensive, so right now he doesn't know of any scientists who are doing them. Harold with the Alaska Marine Conservation Council says the lack of the kind of experiments that Popper's talking about leave Alaska's oceans open to whatever activities the Navy deems necessary to maintain their defense capabilities, including sonar and explosives.
Because we don't know and the science is unclear, doesn't mean there won't be an impact. So we think in that situation, we need to have a very precautionary approach because we're taking multi-million dollar, billion dollar gambles with our renewable fish resources.
A gamble the Navy seems to be willing to take in order to conduct training exercises in the Gulf of Alaska. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Angela Denning Barnes in Crooked Creek, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Lorelei Kanin in Nome, and Daisha Eaton in Dillingham. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. The Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Quitting tobacco is the best thing you can do for your health. Join a free program that will help you create an easy-to-follow plan to quit. It will show you how to get ready, take action, and then live the rest of your life as a non-smoker. Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line provides 8 weeks of patches, gum, or lozenges, and quit coaches that are trained to address Alaskans, including expectant mothers. There's more information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line. It's free, it's confidential, and it works.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.